last case, which is United States versus Rodney Spruill. Mr. Chavez?
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, Your Honors, my name is Ernesto Chavez, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Rodney Spruill. He was convicted after a plea of guilty, and this case involved a motion to suppress based on the Sixth Amendment. That's the first issue. The magistrate held an evidentiary hearing and determined that the government unlawfully extracted a confession from Mr. Spruill in violation of the Sixth Amendment, primarily because they kept him incommunicado from his appointed attorney. Secondly, Spruill was sentenced to 57 months in prison for a crime with a statutory maximum of 5 years.
It wasn't an appointed attorney, was it?
We submit that it was, Your Honor. And that's because
the attorney gets appointed by court order, and here, I thought, maybe I'm wrong, but I thought the record was only that the U.S. Attorney's Office called the federal defender and said they're going to have an initial appearance at 5 o'clock today.
It was an appointment principally because we don't even know whether the magistrate was involved in this case in actually entering the appointment. That very well could have been the case. It's not clear in the record.
I'm sorry. The record as I have read it here is that all that happened was the federal defender was told there's going to be an initial appearance. When you go in front of a judge first of all has to find out whether you qualify for appointed counsel and go through all that litany and then make a formal appointment. At that point, you become the appointed attorney. But you have no authority to act on behalf of a client until that has actually occurred, and that didn't occur here, did it?
Not in that formal sense, Your Honor, but we believe that a federal defender in this position does have authority to act on behalf of the client, principally because often the way it works is the magistrate makes the phone call and assigns counsel before the defendant may even know. At least that's the way it works in the Western District of Wisconsin.
But if the assistant U.S. attorney hadn't called the federal defender's office, would Mr. Spruill have any claim at all, in your view?
Yes, he would, because the federal defendant assigned counsel to Rodney Spruill's case. And it's possible the magistrate actually did it as well. The government
had to
disprove
that.
Well,
are you asking us to create an obligation for an assistant U.S. attorney to procure a lawyer for an indicted defendant before the initial hearing? Is that what you're doing?
Absolutely not. Our request is, succinctly, in a situation in that gap of time before the defendant goes to the initial appearance, maybe a day before the appearance, where two federal offices have agreed to assign an attorney to the case, and even possibly the magistrate has been involved, there should be a per se rule blocking any contact, any conversation, questioning, interrogation in a custodial setting, unless the defendant himself initiates conversation, just like in Edwards versus Arizona. And that's principally because Jackson and Patterson itself held that once an attorney is actually assigned to a case, appointed, there is an obligation upon the government to make sure that the defendant is not questioned outside the kin of counsel unless the defendant knows of that fact. Even in this court does not accept our argument that there's a per se rule that should apply to this case. We believe that the government still has a heavy burden to prove waiver. If this court does not conclude that Spruill was represented, any alleged waiver still must be shown to be under circumstances that did not indicate duress or coercion, and also under circumstances that indicated the defendant waived his right to the Sixth Amendment knowingly and intelligently. Brewer versus Williams requires the courts to engage in a close inquiry of the record to determine whether the defendant actually waived his right to counsel. Patterson further requires that despite any recitation of Miranda warnings, waiver must be accomplished when the defendant has his eyes wide open. In this case, neither was the waiver voluntary or with eyes wide open. First of all, it was involuntary because the conditions under which Spruill was held were essentially inhuman. Spruill was held without proper meals. He was held without, and the record does not indicate he even slept for approximately a 17-hour period. He was cuffed most of the time. And most importantly, he was kept incommunicado from an attorney who was trying to get a hold of him, trying to set up a meeting, had set up a meeting to interview Mr. Spruill.
Well, even the magistrate who you relied on here found that the statement was not in violation of the Fifth Amendment. So you've got a pretty tough road here on voluntariness.
Actually, the magistrate found the opposite. The magistrate found that the Miranda warnings were not enough. And that's really what the crux of this case is.
I thought the magistrate found the Sixth Amendment violation here, right, the counsel, and that's why recommended that the motion to suppress be granted.
Right. The magistrate found a Sixth Amendment violation, but because the Fifth Amendment Miranda waiver was not sufficient. I guess that's what I mean, Your Honor. And in this circumstance, Patterson generally held that a Miranda warning would suffice. But the crux of this case is a Miranda warning does not suffice, especially when it's only given in the morning, vis-a-vis a 5 o'clock waiver, especially when it's given in the morning and the most important matter in this case is not told to Mr. Spruill, that he has an attorney waiting to interview him. Agent Bruce Swellis, one of the FBI agents that was involved in the interrogation, actually testified that had the United States attorney told her that Heather Winslow, the defender, was waiting to interview Ms. Spruill, she would have advised Spruill that exact thing. And Patterson specifically says, if an attorney is trying to contact the defendant, any waiver under Miranda would not suffice, would be meaningless, because if the agents block questioning and don't tell the defendant that an attorney is waiting to interview them. Accordingly, the waiver in this case is insufficient. Under such circumstances as I've just indicated, it can hardly be argued that Mr. Spruill made a waiver, despite the Miranda warning, with his eyes wide open. His eyes were quite shut. As to my second argument concerning sentencing, this case also presents a troubling situation in which the district court imposed extra time to a sentence without enough of a showing that Spruill engaged in significant criminal conduct concerning a second alleged victim, L.B. The facts are not disputed here. And under those facts, the government actually cannot foot its burden to show that L.B. was directed to take a trip in mid-October 2000 to be a prostitute. Rather, the primary co-conspirator, Stepanek, testified she testified that L.B. was to accompany A.K. as a friend who would go out perhaps and party in the city. That's the most damning evidence that the U.S. government has in this case. It must be noted specifically that there is no evidence of any communication between Mr. Spruill or vice versa from the victim, the alleged victim, that indicated she was to be a prostitute. There are no hints, there's nothing in writing, not even so much as a whiff in the air. This represents a gap in the prosecution's evidence that shows that there is no intent was proven on the part of Spruill that LB specifically engaged in prostitution. But even if this court finds that there is some kind of intent on Mr. Spruill's part, the finding that LB is a victim is insufficient under the law of the sentencing guidelines. Specifically, as you know, Application 1, which defines victim. Victim is defined in that case as a person who is transported, enticed, persuaded, induced to go and become a prostitute. In this case, even if Spruill had an intent, there was no action taken by LB. LB was not, under the dictionary definition and the definition of the guidelines, LB was not enticed, induced, she wasn't harmed, she wasn't injured, she wasn't even tricked, which is a very bare minimal showing to be a victim. She actually backed out of any desire to be a prostitute when she found out that this trip was going to be for prostitution. Under those circumstances, the very fact that she turned, so to speak, state's evidence indicates that she was not at all enticed and in fact became an informant for the government. for the government, a private informant. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Okay, thanks. Mr. Yelke?
Thank you. My name is Stephen Elke, and I represent the United States in this case. First, if I might, I'd like to answer some of the questions that Judge Evans and Judge Rovner posed. First, with respect to Judge Evans, you are absolutely correct, Judge. There was no appointment in this case until January 15th, which would have been the Monday of Martin Luther King Day, I believe, in this case, when Mr. Spruill first appeared before the magistrate judge here in this building. And at that time, and the record contains the order, I believe it's Record 44, Exhibit A, contains the magistrate's order appointing Ms. Winslow as attorney for Rodney Spruill. So there was no appointed counsel on Friday at any time when these discussions between the FBI and Mr. Spruill were taking place. Judge Rovner, you asked a question about whether the defendant is asking that a defendant or that an obligation be imposed on the Assistant United States Attorney in this case, and as I view it, and I think I said this in the brief, that is exactly what, in effect, the defendant or the appellant here is asking, that the AUSA would have a duty if the defendant prevails here, but that certainly is not the law. What you do have in this case is an ordinary law enforcement investigation taking place. An indictment had been handed down, so the Sixth Amendment certainly would apply, but at that time period between the indictment and the first appearance. And in order for the Sixth Amendment to apply in this case, Mr. Spruill would have had to invoke his right to counsel. Every case the Supreme Court has handed down, Edwards, Patterson, Burbine, Jackson, they all allow for the defendant in Mr. Spruill's circumstance to make that initial election, whether they're going to go it alone, if you will, or whether they're going to invoke the right to counsel. Mr. Spruill never invoked his right to counsel in this case, and therefore there's no Sixth Amendment violation when the FBI agents are speaking with him, even though the indictment had previously been handed down. There was no appointment in this case. There could not have been an appointment in this case because, as noted in the briefs, under 18 U.S.C. Section 3006, A, paren B, only a magistrate or a district court judge, after proper inquiry, could appoint a counsel for Mr. Spruill in this case. An AUSA making a courtesy phone call to the Federal Defender's Office, under no stretch of her imagination, constitutes an appointment. The appointment issue also could not have occurred in this case, of course, because Mr. Spruill never even met the federal defender. He had never had an opportunity to accept the appointment. If the AUSA's call to the federal defender's office in some manner constituted an appointment or an attempt at an appointment, which I don't believe it did, but even if the court were to say that it did, there would have to be an acceptance of that appointment. The Rodriguez case in the Seventh Circuit here allows for that possibility. The court was very skeptical in that case. The court said, I find it hard to believe that someone would actually appear in front of the magistrate and not have accepted the attorney's appointment. But we'll see. Maybe the record will prove that the person said, no, I don't want you as your attorney, for example. And so the Rodriguez case and the Supreme Court cases, Patterson and so on, all talk about acceptance of appointment. That couldn't have happened here either. So for a number of reasons, there was no invocation of the right to counsel. There was no appointment of counsel in this case. The Sixth Amendment was not violated. In terms of the voluntary issue, voluntariness issue, both the magistrate judge and the district court found that Mr. Spruill's speaking with the FBI agents was voluntary, and I believe the totality of the circumstances in the record would certainly support that. He was looked after by the FBI agents at various times, even when they left him alone in the afternoon to see if he wanted anything. He was provided the McDonald's breakfast in the morning. He was provided popcorn on at least one and perhaps two occasions, and also sodas. He was asked if he needed anything. Presumably, if he were starving to death, he would have said, yeah, I'd like to have something more to eat. And there's nothing to suggest that wouldn't have been provided. after Mr. Spruill was spoken to by the FBI agents again in the evening, he was provided a meal. It was later in the evening, I think around 10 p.m. or something like that. So he had several meals. He was left alone basically in the afternoon. The agent couldn't say whether he was sleeping or not, but she saw him on the bench certainly at several points. Nothing in this record would suggest that this was anything but a voluntary statement given by Mr. Spruill in this case. I don't have much more to add on the sentencing issue other than what's in the brief, unless any of the judges have any questions on that issue this morning, or this afternoon, I guess.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You got a few seconds left.
How much, Your
Honor? 2 seconds. How many?
30.
Oh, thank you.
Despite the fact that we, the defense, cannot prove acceptance of an appointment, there is a strong presumption that once a person has been indicted and is being interrogated in a custodial setting, a critical stage, there is a presumption that that person has accepted appointment, has requested counsel, unless the government proves otherwise. The government has not proved otherwise. Therefore, the waiver is not valid. We believe that that's the dispositive issue in this case, is if the government cannot prove waiver, in other words, by telling us under Patterson that we informed, as Agent Brusuela said, we informed this person, we would have informed this person, and the attorney was waiting to talk to them. The government can't show that. That's what should have been supplemented to the Miranda warning in this case. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, thanks. The case will be taken under advisement. We appreciate your taking the assignment. I understand your court appointed. Thanks very much.
Mr. Chavez, just for your own sake here, I think you just give you a little advice the next time. We have this rule that requires that you put certain things in your blue brief. The most important is the decision and order of the court under review, and Judge Shabazz and the magistrate's decision are not in there. That's really an important rule in the main brief. It has to be in the main brief. You're here with a very friendly panel. I don't think there'll be any sanctions, but just that you should know, if you look, take a look at Westlaw under Rule 30, and you'll see some sanctions that have been imposed on lawyers lately for not doing that. But you did a very fine job here, but I just tell you that for you the next time you're putting a brief together for us.
Okay. That completes our arguments for today. The court will be in recess until 9:30 tomorrow morning.